There are three places I would like you to look at before we enter into this bit of interactive Sunday school instruction time. First place I want you to see is in the book of Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12, and our thoughts this morning will be on worship. Worship is a subject that I have found very few of the greatest scholars are able to define. And I think as a result, many people, when asked about the subject of worship, are able to speak to how they do, but not exactly what it is they do. They may be able to speak as to why they do, but never can they focus on the pure definition of what it involves to worship. And I wonder sometimes if after the Lord's Day, you go home and wonder, really wonder, maybe you have never thought about it this way, after it's all done and the day is over, exactly what did you do? Did we indeed worship? And is worship to be equated with gathering at a certain time of the day, on a certain day of the week, and doing a certain liturgy? We have our hymns, we have our scripture reading, we have our prayers, we have the message. Is that the essence of it? And once participating in that, is it sufficient that our hearts are strengthened through that and drawn closer? But in Romans chapter 12, in the first verse, Romans chapter 12, in the first verse, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. Now keep that verse in mind, and I want to go to two opposite extremes and touch upon the subject of worship. The next place I want you to see is in Isaiah 48. Isaiah 48. And of course, this has this passage will also have a bearing on our morning message, the 11 o'clock hour, on the blind side of liberalism. But I just want you to see opposite poles, opposite extremes of on the subject of worship. In Isaiah 48, the first verse, hear ye this, O house of Jacob, which are called by the name of Israel, and are come forth out of the waters of Judah, which swear by the name of the Lord and make mention of the God of Israel. And then please notice the last part of that verse. But not in truth, nor in righteousness. For they call themselves of the holy city and stay themselves upon the God of Israel. The Lord of hosts is his name. I have declared the former things from the beginning, and they went forth out of my mouth, and I showed them. I did them suddenly, and they came to pass, because I knew that thou art obstinate, and thy neck is an iron sinew, and thy brow brass. I have even from the beginning declared it to thee. Before it came to pass, I showed it thee, lest thou shouldst say, mine idol hath done them, and my graven image and my molten image hath commanded them. Thou hast heard. See all this, and will not ye declare it? I have showed thee new things from this time, even hidden things, and thou didst not know them. They are created now, and not from the beginning. Even before the day when thou heardest them not, lest thou shouldst say, behold, I knew them. Yea, thou heardest not, yea, thou knewest not, yea, from that time that thine ear was not opened. For I knew that thou wouldst deal very treacherously. And then the last part of that verse says, and was called a transgressor from the womb. But I go back up to that verse, first verse. It touches upon the negative extreme when it comes to worship. Here it is that the prophet is redressing Israel, and it is that they apparently are fixed on the outward ceremonial, ritualistic concept of worship. They swear by the name of the Lord, but not in truth, nor in righteousness. Now, it seems to me that there is a correlation between this and what the Lord Jesus said in John chapter 4 when he was talking to the Samaritan woman. And, you know, she too is like a lot of folks who essentially, and of course the key to this difficulty of worship is that last part of verse 8, transgressors from the womb. Innate human depravity and the sinful nature sometimes impedes our grasp of what is right and what is true. But Jesus said to that woman at the well, he said that they that worship God must worship Him in spirit and truth. Now, the two must be together. If people worship in truth, and that's it, it can be similar to this in that there is an orthodox manner, an orthodox understanding of God Himself, where everybody is doing exactly what's right. I mean, for example, the people in the day of Malachi were worshiping according to the truth in a sense, but not in spirit. The two must be together, worship in, according to the truth and spirit. The extreme, again, is seen that if truth stands alone in worship without the Spirit, it can tend to become cold, dead, orthodox, mechanical expression. But on the other side of that, if worship constitutes only that which is of the Spirit but empty of the truth, it can become fanatical, it can become divorced from reality, and it can be all emotional without any really solid roots in what really matters. The two must be always together. Now, Isaiah 48, Romans 12, verse 1, John 4, 24, Malachi present a profile, a negative profile of worship in the opposite or the negative extreme. Now, I want you to see the other side of that. Go to the book of Revelation. The fifth chapter, fourth and fifth chapter. Now, in heaven, I can say pretty safely, it doesn't get any better as we look at the picture in heaven than anywhere else. And I will first, again, present my understanding of that reference in the fourth verse about the 20 of the elders, I believe are symbolic representative of the church raptured in the book of Revelation. And they had on their heads crowns of gold. Very, very important for you to see that they had crowns on their head. Crowns on their head. I will take it from that also that inasmuch as they have crowns in their head, that the Bema Seat judgment has already occurred and that the rewards have already been dispensed to the bride. I will also say to you that in heaven, the elders are there and they make a presentation. They present themselves. Remember what Romans 12, verse 1 said. Romans 12, verse 1 talks about a presentation. Worship with the presentation. And please notice that they present themselves before deity. God there is apparently very present. And I want you to notice the expression of angelic beasts in verse 8. Each had of them six wings about him. They were full of eyes within. They rest not day and night, saying, "Holy, holy, holy." You see, worship does indeed have something to do with what you say. And it has merit only if what you say is rooted to the conviction of truth in your heart. Holy, holy, holy. They knew that was true. They believed it was true. They acted upon it. And here are beasts who have never known experientially what sin is. And yet they are vigorously expressing holiness of God. and the eternality of God, also expressed in verse number 8. Then at verse number 10, it says the 24 elders do something. This is worship here. But listen, pure, cold, mechanical, orthodox religion can have people literally cop a posture while at worship and be void of the truth. Here in heaven, however, the elders fall down before him that was sat on the throne, worship him that liveth forever and ever. And then they took their crowns. They make a presentation, twofold presentation. They presented, first of all, themselves. And secondly, they presented something material to their God, their crowns. They expressed, "Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory, honor, and power, and Thou hast created all things. And for Thy pleasure they are and were created." Now, we get a little bit of an understanding about worship and the purpose for your creation and mine. God here expresses a baseline concept that you and I were created solely for His pleasure. We worship at His pleasure, which is to say, it brings Him pleasure when we worship. Now, if you go down through the fifth chapter, the worship continues. And a lot of good things come out of that. I want you to come down to the eighth verse. "When he had taken the book, four beasts and 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having every one of them harps, golden vials full of odors, which are the prayers of the saints." So I'm going to say again that you link up with worship instrumental music as well as prayer. Now, again, I will say that you can have those components in a public worship service, and it can take on the tone of the Isaiah 48 folks. It can take on the tone of the people in Malachi who were doing all the things, all the components for worship were there, but the spirit wasn't in it, which is to say, the heart wasn't in it. So you can have instrumental music, you can have prayers without the heart being truly, sincerely engaged in worship. And it means absolutely nothing to God. If you read the first chapter of the book of Isaiah, God laments about how he's weary. He's grown weary of the sacrifices that the people offer him. And because the heart wasn't there. The heart wasn't there. So it is said here in verse 9, they sang a new song, saying, "Thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof, for Thou hast slain and hast redeemed us to God by Thy blood out of every kindred, tongue, and people and nation." The very fact, and this goes to ownership now, something else that's key to worship. Ownership. There's only one person in the universe, exclusively one person, who is to be worshipped. And that's the owner of the universe, your creator. Man is not entitled to worship. Objects are not entitled to worship. Buildings are not entitled to worship. God only entitled to worship. And it derives from ownership. You see, the ninth verse here reiterates something else. There's a purchase been made. Something that the Apostle Paul discusses in his book to the Corinthians. When you were saved, you were purchased. God made a purchase of blood. He owns you. And please understand me when I say this. If I use a four-letter word like duty, to some people that's like cussing. But you know, worship is duty. But it is duty that does not spin out of a compulsory, pharisaical need to salve the conscience. Duty in the sense of what the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes says in the 12th chapter of his book. This is the whole duty of man. Duty there, I understand, is noble because it outlines very simple what the duty of man is. To fear God and to keep His commandments. Essential to worship is also fear of Him. And I will say that people will not worship if they do not fear Him. People will not worship God in spirit and in truth if they do not fear Him. So duty enters into this. Now, having said all that, presented the negative pole, the positive side, and laid down this track in Romans chapter 12, verse 1. Let me ask you this question. Now think before you speak. You may want to write it down, because I know that if you're like me, if you don't write something down, when you get a flash of brilliance, it's gone. It's gone. If somebody asks you 10 minutes later, what did you just say? Can you repeat that verbatim? My answer is usually no, I can't. I don't remember what I just said. So write this down if you get a flash. Help me out. Do for me this morning, teach me this morning what the wisest Bible scholars were unable to do. They have in all of their works, they had the tremendous capacity to write page after page after page about stuff. But when it came to the topic of worship, I get a line here and a line there, a paragraph here that basically said nothing. So help me out. Worship. Without referencing at all how you worship, tell me what worship is. Keep out how you worship. Tell me what worship is. Take a few moments. Take a few moments to think about that. Type A personality. Have a couple minutes gone past? Get your bonus, man. One more. In Romans chapter 12, verse 1, let me read this again to you, then I want to get your input. Romans 12, verse 1 says, I beseech you. We stop right there. The word beseech. Very tender word. And going back on what we understand about the inspiration of Scripture, this word beseech is the very word God wanted the Apostle Paul to write to communicate His will on the subject. Beseech is a tender word. And so the tone is set for whatever else follows, that it should not be construed. You should not be able to paint a picture here of a powerful ogre standing over you with a ball bat, forcing you to do something that you maybe don't want to do, or you're not inclined to. So he says, I beseech you, brethren. Brethren, that's another tender word, because he includes himself with those whom he addresses. Paul never writes, never speaks from a superior position, looking down the proverbial ski slope of his nose to the people that being communicated to. So he said, I beseech you, therefore, brethren. The word therefore points back to everything else that he's just talked about. May I point out to you that when you think about the word therefore, and you just scan the chapters previous, chapter 11 talks about the grand, deep doctrinal truth of election and the place of Israel in the plan and purpose of God. Chapter 10 is also a great chapter about the gospel of the grace of God. Chapter 9, Israel, election. Chapter 8, wow, what a great chapter Romans 8 is. I am persuaded neither death nor life nor anything, present, past, would be able to separate you from the love of God. All things work together for good to them that love God. Chapter 7 talks about the nature of sin, the battle that you and I face, doing things we don't want to do and not doing things we want to do and so forth and so on. Chapter 6 talks about your deliverance from sin. You were in bondage to sin as unbelievers, and now having been saved by the grace of God, you are free to serve God. You go back to chapter 5 of the book on Romans, and there's that great chapter again about grace. Chapters 4 and 5, justification by faith through grace. And yet interspersed in that is the truth about man's depravity and how it was that sin entered the world. Now, having well said all that, therefore, presupposes that worship is built on the truth, solid doctrinal truth. Because all that's come before in the book of Romans up to chapter 12 has been solid doctrinal truth. Now, chapters 12 through the end of the book is a section that basically gives instruction on here's what you're supposed to do with what you were just taught about the doctrine. So therefore, it goes way back. By the mercies of God, that you present your bodies. The Old Testament economy would bring the body of another, an animal, part of their worship. But he says here, you present your bodies. Your bodies. Not like the Muslims do, that present their bodies enveloped in explosives. But you present your bodies as a living sacrifice, but a sacrifice nevertheless. Qualitatively holy. And inasmuch as it's holy, it's acceptable to God. Then it talks about reasonable service. Reasonable. So you connect this word service with the word worship. They're companions. Now, having said that, tell me what you think. Worship. Without addressing how to worship, what is it? What is it? Don't be shy. This isn't a right or wrong. Nobody's going to pass or fail. Just, what do you have? Worship. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Would it be fair to say that worship is verbal? Continue. Sir? Okay. Can you expand on that? Can you expand on the attitude at all? I would take it you mean it has to be a good attitude. Okay, we'll go there. Yes, Teresa? Sure you can. Did you take that excerpt out of the dogmatic theology of the Myers? Whoa. Wow, that was good. Now, can I ask you to do something else? If you take your foot off the pedal just a bit, would you repeat that? Read me the whole thing again, slower. Excellent. Anyone else? Anyone else with an idea? Good. Very good, Austin. Excellent. Anything else? Other? Okay. All right. Anyone else? Anyone else? Now, let me, while you're stewing there for a minute, at 12 o'clock today, at 12 o'clock, when you're on your way out the door, in the car, heading home, will you be able to sense, is the human being able to sense whether they have worshipped or not? Are you able to sense whether you have worshipped or not? Now again, if you do like so many do, confuse time and place and routine as being the sole composition of worship, you could probably say very simply, yes, I went to worship today. Or I attended a worship service today. But the question is, when you're on your way home, will you be able to sense whether you indeed worshiped God or not? Now, Missy says it's an action. And it is that. And with the other enhancements that were given, it's all that. You have more comment. Okay, very good. How many of you have ever seen that that artist show on public TV where the guy, very quiet little place where he paints, has his canvas up there, a blank canvas. A studio is what I'm thinking, artist studio. He's got himself a big old canvas there, blank canvas. And on this side, he's got his little, and again, I don't know the word for it, the little paint buckets. Can anybody help me out with what I'm talking about? It's not buckets, but he's able to take his brush and he's able to, a palette, okay, paint palette. And he's got all kind of sizes of brushes, all kind of brushes, some real skinny, some hardly can even see the feathers on, or the bristles on them. But he starts out this way. He takes a brush and he makes just one seemingly random motion on the canvas and he leaves his paint there. starts talking. Very, you know, if you weren't really wanting to see what he's going to do, you'd fall asleep because the guy's got that kind of monotone voice. There you are. And he takes his paint and he starts little bit by little bit. Keeps talking, does a little painting. And as you're watching, pretty soon, it starts taking shape. And after he's all done, you say, wow. Impressive. I mean, that's just as impressive as a person who can just sit down at a piano or an organ or pick up a piece of brass instrumentality or strings and play it. Impressive. Now, we want to do that this morning where worship is concerned. We're going to take one broad, random, seemingly random stroke, and let's see if we can paint a portrait of worship using the paint of Holy Scripture. We've already looked at Romans 12, verse 1. I've already mentioned John 4, 24, Malachi. I've already seen it in Isaiah 48, Revelation 3, 4. Put that aside now for a moment. That would be like the canvas that we're using. Now let's put some color on this. In the few moments that we have left, let's see how many strokes of paint we can put up there. Deuteronomy chapter 26. Deuteronomy 26. The whole chapter deals with the subject of offerings. I would just have you look at the 10th verse. And again, I will say to you that I'm reasonably confident that I'm, even though I'm addressing your attention to one verse in a chapter, that if you want to take the time and on your own time, you will find that nothing will be taken and stripped out of its context to make it say what it doesn't really say. So you have Deuteronomy 26:10, and it says, "Now behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land, which thou, O Lord, hast given me. And thou shalt set it before the Lord thy God, and worship before the Lord thy God." Now keep in mind, drawing back from this wild stroke we put on, with one word, present. Paul says, present your bodies. Okay, now, if you look at the 10th verse here, the offerings are described as what? What kind? What are they? First fruits. First fruits. That means at harvest time, the offerer does not wait until everything has been gathered and dispatched and stockpiled, and then he goes through and picks up what's left and then brings it for an offering. The first fruits are the offerings that are taken initially at harvest time. They're the first things removed from that which God has provided. Now, remember what Paul said. Present your bodies. Associate that presentation with first fruits. And there's also an acknowledgement. The point of the source of origin for the offering itself was from God. Where did you get your body? From God. Psalm 139 is very clear about where you got your body. That among many other places. Thou shalt set it before the Lord. There speaks to the place of worship. What do you do with the presentation? Paul says, present your bodies a living sacrifice to the Lord. Here, Deuteronomy 26 says, take the first fruits, present it before the Lord, and then it says, worship before the Lord thy God. Now, if you read down through there, you can see such words as rejoice. Verse 11. You can see some other little things all through this 26th chapter. All I would have you remember the key word presentation. First fruits, Deuteronomy 26:10, to be set before the Lord. That's the presentation. I want you to then go to 2 Kings chapter 17. In the 36th verse, after having given counsel about how not to worship, he says, verse 36, "But the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt with a great power and a stretched out arm, Him shall ye fear, Him shall ye worship, and to Him ye shall ye do sacrifice." Three things there. Fear, worship, sacrifice. Fear, worship, and sacrifice. Do sacrifice. Paul says, present your bodies a living sacrifice. So there is the presentation. The presentation. Now, on the word worship for a moment. This may, if worship is to be reduced to mechanical posturing, it may present a challenge to most of us. Maybe with the possible exception of Johnny Grimm, Shane and Jenny. But I would gather that if posture is the sum of worship, we are all going to be challenged, because basically the word that means worship here, shaka, means to stoop over. And more than stoop over, it means to lie prostrate on the ground. New Testament 21st century churches are not designed in the strict technical sense for worship. Unless, and I'm not saying it's impossible, but I would challenge anybody here to lie prostrate on the floor right where you're sitting. And if you're able to do that, here's the challenge: getting back up. Getting back up. It's not impossible. It's just not as easy as it once may have been. I'm always, having lived with Asians and Orientals for a year, I was very impressed with their outward courtesy and custom toward each other. Whenever they would greet a person, they always assumed that the person they were greeting was superior to them. And the way they did that was, upon most every greeting, there would always be the reluctance on the part of the one doing the greeting to look eye to eye with that person. Would always have downcast eyes, would always be bent over in a very posture like this, and they would make their greetings all the time. And I noticed that there was a distinction made. A person was sincere in their greeting if they were confident enough to take that posture and look down with their eyes right to the ground. The exception to that rule is whenever they would meet a person that they were kind of wary of, and they would always like this, with the eyes up. Okay? But the assumption was that the person approaching is better than me. So when you think about that picture of the posture, it is an attitude as well as an action that flows out of the heart of the individual who, when they enter in to make that presentation of their sacrifice to God, they are bowed down. May I say to you, that in it, just in on that one point only, and I'll quit at this juncture, on that one point only, contemporary modern worship misses the whole concept. For they approach God not as a necessary superior, but an equal. There is an overfamiliarity, an attitude conveyed in that, and a casuality that diminishes the worthiness of God, as I would take from Revelation chapter 4 and 5. Worship ought not to take on any other form than what you see it in its last form, and that's in heaven. So think about that. Bring your notes and your thinking hat back next week. I want to pick up the subject matter of worship once again. Would you pray with me, please?